The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can get a free audiobook and start your free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hello!
Hi!
And welcome to week 29 of the
Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
And I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Miriam Mirzakhani.
Nice. I am going to be talking to you about Shajar al-Dur.
Love. We picked two women from the Middle East.
Get excited.
So ready. So, Miriam Mirzakhani was born on May 3rd, 1977. She is still alive in Tehran, in Iran. And this is 2 years before the Iran hostage crisis in 1979, which is what Argo is based off of. As a girl, she wanted to be a writer, creating characters and stories in her head. She read every book she could get her hands on and even watched TV biographies on famous women who changed the world. She talks about going into bookshops and they didn't allow browsing, so they'd just go and buy a book. And apparently books were cheap enough that they could just go and each week they'd buy a new book.
There goes the baker with his tray.
Exactly. After elementary school, she's placed into an advanced middle school called Farzanegan. She actually does testing and she gets placed into it. And this school is administered by Iran's National Organization for Development of Exceptional Talents, which I didn't know Iran had.
Hey!
But apparently, there you go. Her first year was a little bit of a letdown. She did poorly in math and lost interest in it until the next year when a more understanding teacher reignited her passion the next year. And it said from her second year in that middle school on, she was a star. She couldn't be stopped.
It's all about the teachers.
I call them moments of grace. These moments where you meet the right person at the right time and just work. In 1994, she had moved on from Farzanegan Middle School into the Farzanegan High School. These were segregated schools by gender. So there was an all-women one and an all-men's one. And the all-men's one had these very intense higher-level math courses. And they were sending people to the statewide math Olympiad tryouts, because there's these national math Olympiads.
Yeah.
And one of her years, she went to the national thing, but not as a competitor. And they have 3 hours to do 6 questions. And she was able to do 3 of them.
Wow.
And the next year, she insisted to her principal that they have those kinds of math courses. Her and her other mathematician friend, Roya Beheshti, who she met at this middle school. And they got them. They got the math classes. And the next year, in 1994 at 17, she and her friend, Roya, became the first women to make the Iranian math Olympiad team.
That's awesome.
That year they got gold medals. Well, that year Miriam got a gold medal.
Right.
And then the next year she went back for her final time and got a perfect score.
Whoa!
This is an international mathematics.
Holy cow.
And she got a perfect score.
Oh my goodness.
So she completes her undergrad in 1999 at Sharif University in Tehran, and then makes her way to Harvard for graduate school.
Of course.
Of course.
As you do.
Her work focused mainly on hyperbolic surfaces, which are, and this is how Wired, I found this really great article on Wired about her and her life that went into the kind of depth that we like to go to on Bitchery. And Wired explains this as donut-shaped surfaces with two or more holes that have a non-standard geometry, which, roughly speaking, gives each point on the surface a saddle shape.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, and I know we've talked about this before, and you've independently on your own, like, gone and looked at this kind of math.
Yes.
And you like to read these?
Well, it's closely related to quantum physics.
Right.
And theoretical physics.
Yeah, some of her work goes into string theory.
Right. And string theory and M theory, which I find really fascinating.
Absolutely.
And is one of the other subjects among the many that I independently research and read on in my spare time.
Same. I mean, you know,
as
honestly.
As people do, right?
Exactly.
That's normal.
And this is, she gets into these things called theoretical geometry, which is a very interesting concept for me. Until I started researching her, I didn't realize that there was anything other than just, like, geometry.
Oh, yeah. Which, there's, I mean, way more.
It makes sense that there's way more. But this is finding... So she starts finding these things called geodesics. And a geodesic is a normal geometric function that's found on these hyperbolic surfaces, or these Riemannian surfaces, as they're also called in some mm-hmm. places, depending on what they look like. And these geodesics, they're divided into two categories, simple versus closed. And simple, if you can find the simple ones, they unlock secrets. And the simple ones are where you can, like, draw one line and then it'll never interact with itself,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a closed geodesic, which will interact with itself,
right.
which will come and make a point
right.
with itself somewhere. And the simple ones are mathematically incredibly difficult find, or even to calculate or to figure it out. And they had been unsolved for decades since they first started talking about these hyperbolic surfaces. And she did it in her grad school thesis. She did it while finding connections to two other difficult research questions, which concerned the volume of moduli spaces, which I'm going to talk about a little bit in a second. And the other was a new proof on an old conjecture, which was also on moduli spaces, the first proof of which earned its discoverer a Fields Medal.
Nice.
So she found a second proof, and apparently it was like one line. And it was very simple and very elegant. And
that's
very
the
easy.
Best. When math is elegant, it's the best.
Exactly. And so her thesis then goes on. Her thesis went on to produce three papers,
mm-hmm.
which were published in three of the greatest mathematical journals in the world. The Annals of Mathematics, Inventionis Mathematica, and the Journal of the American Mathematical Society.
Awesome.
Right? And then in 2006, and this is the crux of what mm-hmm. I'm talking about her today. In 2006, she teams up with this guy named Alex Eskin,
mm-hmm.
who helped her to prove that the complex geodesics and their closures in moduli spaces are surprisingly regular rather than irregular or fractal, as had been previously understood or previously believed.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
Right? So their paper, which they published together,
mm-hmm.
is called Invariant and Stationary Measures for the, and then a mathematical symbol I don't know, Action on Moduli Space.
Sweet.
It's 207 pages long.
Holy cow.
And there are more symbols and numbers in there that I do not understand than I have ever seen before in my life. But what she did was essentially say, you know this thing that we all think is mathematically impossible or that doesn't happen that often? It's actually not that difficult. The main crux of her argument is, instead of thinking about these geodesics as having their own crazy theoretical geometry to them, we can explain them using regular basic geometry.
Does she tie this into, like, multi-universe or parallel dimensions
yes.
at all?
Yes. One of her favorite things to do, and it talks about this in the Wired article,
you need to send
is that she talks about how one of the things she likes doing and enjoys doing is finding connections between the different sciences and the different mathematical...
Because they're closely related, like quantum physics and parallel
Because they're all very closely
related.
And her idea, and the reason she likes doing it so much,
uh-huh.
is because she calls them these invisible barriers, these fake barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, no, they're all connected. And if we think about everything as being connected, we can come to these elegant solutions. She talks a lot about it being a very elegant, very beautiful
mm-hmm.
thing that you have to study very. She says it takes a lot of studying to see the beauty in math. And she grew up reading all these books. She wanted to be a writer at first.
Right.
She wanted to be an author. And now she creates stories and creates words using mathematical concepts instead.
I love it.
So this work that they published this paper on, I found this little excerpt from this Wired. It's another little Wired excerpt.
Okay.
And they're talking about billiards, about
mm-hmm.
pool.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a lot of very complex math that comes out of billiards, out of the game billiards. And it's talking about if you place mirrors on the walls of a billiard table, a ball bouncing off a wall looks as if it's continuing to roll in a straight line in the looking glass world.
Yeah. Right.
Follow this straight path through one looking glass after another as the ball hits more walls. And after a finite number of reflections, you'll be back in a billiard table world that has the exact same orientation as the original table.
Yes.
Now, if you glue together the sides of this finite succession of billiard table worlds, which are in all these mirrors, you end up with a surface, a donut with two or more holes, mm-hmm. that inherits a flat geometry from the billiard table. Paths on the original billiard table correspond to straight lines on this surface, called a translation surface. And mathematicians have shown that understanding the moduli space of all translation surfaces is the key to understanding billiards.
Also the key to understanding Interstellar.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's how you connect two completely unconnected spaces that are actually connected through all these different... Mm-hmm. After they did this paper, their newest work, they're currently working on expanding the work that they posted this paper on mm-hmm. to develop and explore a complete list of the kinds of sets that translation surface orbits can fill up. Because they think if...
Pocket universes.
Once you have the list of things that are possible, then you can apply that to the various different things and use it as a shortcut. So it would be a way to say, look, identify the surface that you're working with. Here's the set of translations that are available. Use these. Don't figure them out. We've got them already.
Beautiful.
Right? So in 2014, this is the big thing. Miriam became the first woman to win a Fields Medal.
Yes.
And she won it for her, quote, outstanding contributions to the dynamics and geometry of Riemann surfaces and their moduli spaces. For those of you who don't know, the Fields Medal...
It's like the Nobel Prize, but for math.
It is the Nobel Prize, yes. So the Fields Medal is a prize awarded to 2, 3, or 4 mathematicians under 40 years of age at the International Congress of the International Mathematical Union, which only happens every 4 years.
Wow.
So they've done it, I think, since the 50s, and they've only had 55 winners of the Fields Medal.
Wow.
And it is like the Nobel Prize for mathematics, because there is no Nobel Prize for mathematics. Yeah. So that's her big thing. She became the first woman to break that glass ceiling.
That's awesome.
Love. She's one of my new favorite people. And one of my new favorite, like, I'm always very interested when I find a field of study that just makes my head hurt. Because
mm-hmm.
I consider myself a fairly intelligent human being. And this is just...
Welcome to quantum physics,
it just hurts. No, I mean, I've been here. I just didn't know about theoretical geometry.
Read some Brian Greene.
Love him, yeah.
Him
and Neil deGrasse Tyson.
So good. So, we're going to stay in kind of the Middle East area, but we're going to go way back in time. Shajar al-Durr, and I did look up how to pronounce that name, and every single clip said it differently.
Oh,
so
good.
We're going with it. She was of Turkic origin, which refers to an ethnic group of people from Eastern Europe and also South and Central Asia. Just kind of that...
Turkic, not Turkish.
Yeah, Turkic. So North Africa as well, just kind of in that general area. She was born sometime around 1220.
Mm-hmm.
Date and exact year, you know, TBD.
Sure.
She was described as described by historians as a beautiful, pious, and intelligent woman. She was purchased as a slave, though, by Asali Ayub.
Mm-hmm.
Before he became a sultan, and accompanied him kind of as his concubine, mm-hmm. if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But things went pretty well, and he became sultan, and in 1240 she went with him to Egypt, and there gave birth to their son, Khalil. And sometime after the birth, they got married, they seemed to get along really well, things were going pretty great. And then the Crusades start coming along, and the French army's coming, and it gets worse. The sultan dies.
Oh, no.
And Shajar is like, he's dead. My son's not old enough to rule. And we have this French army, King Louis IX, on their marches on the Crusades coming to get us. Here's what we're going to do, guys. Don't tell anyone the sultan is dead. He's very sick and he can't see anyone, and I'll be in charge.
Fantastic. I love that this is where this is going.
Right. So she just quietly kind of took the reins of the country, with the help of her husband's chief commander, she prepped for war, and they basically stomped out the invaders, took Louis IX, the king of France, prisoner in an incredibly humiliating defeat.
Love.
Now, Louis IX was really pretty sure he was gonna win. He actually sent a letter to the Sultan that served absolutely no purpose other than to just basically say, I'm coming for you bitches.
Right.
And it said if the Sultan were to convert to Christianity, Louis would still track him down and kill him, quote, at your dearest spot on earth, end quote.
Dang.
So,
that's rude.
So Shazar is like, that's not happening.
Right.
So when the French forces, after they had like a couple small victories on their way.
Right.
You know, because they're marching all the way to Jerusalem.
Sure.
They're on a whole crusade. They're not just coming to try and invade her land. They're just
they're
trying
to
take
everyone's
over
land.
Everyone's land.
Right.
So they had a couple small victories. They rushed into a town that they thought was empty, only to be slaughtered by all of the hidden soldiers and townsfolk. And also, Egyptian soldiers carried boats over land, then dropped them into the water so that any French reinforcements could not come by water. They torched the crusader ships with Greek fire, and then that's how they took Louis IX hostage. They were like, yeah, you lose. And thus ended the Seventh Crusade. Now, back in France,
right,
this did not go down very well.
Oh, of course it didn't.
And it actually caused this event called the Shepherd's Revolt, which was basically all these farmers saying, we're going to have our own crusade, but they're farmers, so they don't really know what they're doing.
Right.
So rather than marching on a crusade, they kind of end up just wandering the French countryside murdering priests.
Oh.
Whoops.
Oh, well, that'll help. Wait, yeah. Why are they murdering priests if it's a Christian
Because
crusade?
They were crazy farmers. Like, things just did not go well in France. And so this was the Seventh Crusade. There were later two other crusades, but they were kind of half-hearted and they both failed. So you could say that her defeat of them ended the crusades.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Dang.
Now, back to having captured Louis IX, she decided to ransom him back to France for 30% of their GDP. 400,000 livres tournois.
Oh my god.
So according to rejectedprincesses.com, which is where I got her story,
right,
and is the best website ever, this is, quote, like Obama being captured while on a tour of Iraq and then ransomed back to the U.S. for $5 trillion.
Jesus Christ.
Right? Below your mind. So, like, yeah, I'll give him back to you if you give me $5
trillion.
That's
like Dr. Evil.
Right?
$5 trillion.
$1 trillion.
Dang.
And
did she get it?
Yep. Now that was handled. On to the matter of succession. Turan Shah, the son of the dead sultan, knew that he wouldn't have full power while Shajar al-Durr and kind of her Mamluks and the old guards of his late father were around. He decided to just kind of work on taking over. So he detained some officials, replaced some old officials, including the deputy sultan, and then he sends a message to Shajar, warning her that he's gonna take over. And requesting her to hand him over the wealth of the nation, the jewels of his father. And this request and kind of his manners really did not go down well.
Yeah.
She complained to her companions, to the Mamluks, about his threats and his ungratefulness. And their leader and all of them were enraged that the son would treat her like this. He also used to drink alcohol, which is definitely a no-no. This is a Muslim country.
This is a Muslim country, yeah.
So that's, they're like, that's super not cool.
Right.
He abused the bondmaids of his father and threatened the Mamluks. And so he was assassinated.
Oh, no.
On May 2nd, 1250.
Well, bye.
Kind of badly. First, he was stabbed, so he fled into a nearby tower. Then the tower was set on fire, so he jumped out of it and ran for the river. Then he got a spear in the gut, but made it to the river anyway. Then he got shot at with arrows from the shore, still somehow surviving. So finally, one of the military commanders just waded out into the water and hacked him to death. So he didn't go down easy, but he went down. Like,
It's a little bit of a...
A little bit of an overkill, you might say?
Well, it's also a little bit is of an embarrassment. Like, you ended the Crusades, but you can't kill a...
I mean, maybe he was drunk at the time?
Rasputin apparently went through the same thing, where, like, he was stabbed or poisoned mm-hmm. and then stabbed, and then he was in the river, and then all over.
Now, again, also, this is 1250, yeah. so it could be that one of these things happened and multiple reports right. have survived.
Right.
But... At least what I have read, all of these things went down. Yeah. He really got it in the end. So after that, Shajar was officially installed as the Sultan, and she had the support of the military. She printed her own coins and led her own prayers. Wow. And these two acts can only be done for the person who carries the title of Sultan.
Wow, yeah.
Especially like in a Muslim country at this time, leading her own prayers...
Wow.
Woman is awesome.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, as you might imagine, other factions in Egypt and kind of throughout the land were not super cool with a lady on the throne, so things began to unravel. Egypt at this time was under the authority of the Caliphate at Baghdad, mm-hmm. and Baghdad did not really approve of this idea. They said, you know, she's a woman, she can't hold the title of ruler, she basically has to get married. So the Caliph of Baghdad sends a message that says... Quote, since no man among you is worthy of being Sultan, I will bring you one, end quote. So she's pretty humiliated and decides she'll step down after being Egypt's Sultan for only 2 months. However, then a successful soldier is appointed in her place. This soldier, she manages to seduce him. And he marries her to legitimize her rule. Reports tell of their great love for one another, but he could also have kind of been chosen because he was easy to manipulate. Right. And an historian who lived at the time comments, she dominated him. He had nothing to say.
Sure.
So it could also have been like, why don't you step down and then we'll let this guy and then you marry him. And then it's like, you're still in power and it's all still cool. Like, we'll be friends. So that kind of was okay for a while. But after a couple of years, her husband, Ibek, decided to take another wife, which would be his third, to continue to help solidify his power. And she was not really cool with this idea. She's like, I don't want that. So she either had servants strangle him while he was in the bath, or she was there too, beating him and rubbing soap in his eyes. Stories differ.
Rubbing soap in his eyes.
I mean, if you're gonna strangle someone in the bath, use what's nearby.
In the eyes?
I mean, soap in your eyes would hurt. You've never gotten soap in your eye?
It just feels like malignant. It just feels like...
Oh, of course. I think it's super malignant, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, this seems a little over the top.
Yeah, well...
You're already strangling the dude. Why you gotta rub soap in his eyes?
Anyway, shortly thereafter, Shajar met her end. According to legend, she was caught in the act of killing her husband... And imprisoned and then
probably
executed.
Probably because he was screaming because he was having soap rubbed in his eyes.
Who knows? She was then executed by his first wife.
Oy.
We don't really know. Mm-hmm. However, the dynasty that she started with her ascension, one where the Mamluk servant class became the rulers of Egypt, went on to last for over 300 years, repelling Mongol and Crusader invasions and lasted until the rise of the Ottomans.
Nice.
So she really got some stuff
done. Yeah, what a roller coaster of a life, too.
For real. I just also love the, like, don't tell anyone the Sultan is dead. I will handle it.
Right.
It's like Olivia Pope, but in 1220. Like,
yeah.
It's handled.
It's handled.
Crusaders, no problem.
I got this. Don't worry.
Yeah. Oh, you want your king back? Can you give me $5 trillion?
Right.
Thanks.
That's actually my favorite part.
Yeah.
Like, I would like $5 trillion.
I think that's how much your king is worth. Don't agree with me? I'll kill him. Like, what a badass, for real.
Seriously.
Let's take a moment and talk to you about our partners at audible.com. You can get a free audiobook and start your free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Today, we want to recommend the book I Am Malala, How One Girl Stood Up for Education and Changed the World.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that since we were talking about strong women, we were talking about the Middle East, that Malala was a perfect choice.
Absolutely. Have you seen her interview on Jon Stewart?
Yes.
It's amazing. I was in
so
tears.
Good.
I was in tears. It's so good.
So you can get I Am Malala as well as more than 100,000 books available for download at audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Nice.
Hey y'all, if you've been enjoying the podcast, we would really appreciate if you could go to the iTunes or Google Play Music Store or Stitcher or Podomatic, wherever you're listening to it, and leave us a rating or a comment. Those ratings and comments help other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. Thanks. So today in herstory.
On August 15th, 1970, Patricia Palinkas became the first woman to play professionally on an American football game, or in an American football game, as a place kick holder for the Orlando Panthers.
Nice. On August 18th, 1587, Virginia Dare was born, the first English child born in the New World.
Go Virginia Dare. And then they all disappeared. Look into the Roanoke Island colony, guys.
Heyo, North Carolina.
What up? On August 18th, 1920, Tennessee ratified the 19th Amendment, which gave the vote to women in the U.S.
Yes.
When people ask me, because we do live in Los Angeles, so people more here than other places I've been, definitely ask you, like, what's your sign?
What's your sign? They tell me about my aura.
Yes. But when people go, they always ask in this confused way, like, they can't quite figure me out. And they go, what's your sign? I can't place it. And I go, I'm a Leo. And the reaction, 99.9% of the time is, Oh, yeah.
Same. Yeah. I'm Leo with Virgo rising. I've had people stop me on the street and go, your aura is great. You have a very powerful aura. And it's like,
thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What color is it?
What color is it?
I get different answers. It's always something in like the blue, purple, red blue range. I don't know what that
blue
means.
Blue and red
though
are different. Blue and purple are similar. I feel like blue and red are different.
Well, purple is blue and red together.
Yeah.
So, our term of the week?
We're going to be talking about girls' education.
Girls' education.
Here are some facts that I have from a UNESCO report from October of 2013. So, it's a little dated, but it's probably still, unfortunately, pretty accurate information. Yeah. So, there are 31 million girls of primary school age out of school. And of these, 17 million are expected to never enter school. There are 4 million fewer boys than girls out of school. So, it definitely is a girls' rights and a women's rights issues. But girls' education has a huge impact on all of society. Educated women are less likely to die in childbirth. They are more likely, the more educated a woman is, to, it narrows the pay gap. There is, of course, still the pay gap, but it will narrow it.
Right.
Education keeps hunger away. Mother's education improves children's nutrition. It's vital to eliminate malnutrition in the long term, especially education that empowers women. It lessens early marriages and early births. So it's hugely, it's not just about, you know, go to your school and go earn the Fields Medal for mathematics.
Oh, yeah, no.
It's truly just at the basis, it will make your life better.
And I think we've seen, we've explored so many women in this podcast already. We're on week 29, which means we've done, what, 58 women.
Yeah.
And of all of those, how many of those stories started with her father educated her in secret, or she was educated at some point in her life? And education for every single one of those women who was educated during a time when, or in a place where education for girls wasn't the standard, those girls, I mean, obviously there's usually other financial implications, other financial things that are helping them as well, but without exception, every single one of those girls who receives some kind of formalized education does better in their life.
Absolutely.
Does better in political, does better in childbirth, like you said, in raising kids, does better in literally every single aspect of their life.
Yes.
And it's one of those few things, education, and this might sound a little, you know, hokey pokey, but education is one of the few things that you can't take from someone. So if you do your best to educate and you give everyone the education that they need to live, if, you know, God forbid something happens in a country and they become refugees or they become, you know, something where they're displaced, you can lose literally everything, but your education stays with you. Your knowledge of how the world works, your knowledge of the things that you can do to kind of sustain your life and recreate a life comes from education.
Absolutely. Malala has a fund, an education fund.
Yes, donate to Malala.
What's the website that people can do that at?
It's malala.org. So that's MALALA.org. You can go and support her foundation. Donate if you can, or otherwise just spread the word, like we ask every week. I think it's also very important to start thinking about ways in which we need to revolutionize the education we're already giving people around the world, both girls and boys. because a lot of our education system is based on this industrial revolution where we have math and science set at the top, and now we have to talk about bringing the arts back in, talk about bringing all these other things which help to round out an education, which help to connect points.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for listening this week, guys.
Yes. If you'd like to keep in contact with us, share your stories about powerful teachers or powerful educational experiences that you've had in your life, you can do that at facebook.com/UMPBOH.
We are also on Twitter and Instagram at that same handle, at UMPBOH.
For just a few cents a podcast or a few dollars a podcast, whatever you're able to give, you can help support us at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. Patreon is a great website that allows you to support artists and creative peoples as they create original content.
The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions, which also produces and brings you Shaky Understanding. We have associate producer Chris McNeil, intern Katie Chang, and contributors Grace Seaman and Ella Moore.
Shaky Understanding is also hosted by Allison and our good friend Beverly.
Look at that. It's great.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.